Hello everyone, and thanks for joining us again on the Rambling Through Albion podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Ine.
We didn't stray too far from home this weekend, but every corner of London has something different to offer, and we don't have to go hundreds of miles to find something of interest. So we're going to regale you with our weekend visits to Dulwich, but first, to Whitechapel.
Whitechapel is quite notorious.
It is indeed. It has a fascinating history and it's still a really lively place. It's probably a bit safer, thankfully, than it was in Victorian times when some madman was roaming around the streets killing prostitutes. We'll get back to that later, but we'll start as ever with a few basic facts. For those of you who don't know, Whitechapel is in East London, about 5.5 kilometres from the centre of the city. You can get there by bus. I think the number 25 from Oxford Circus takes about 50 minutes, but a quicker option is to go by underground. The District Line from Embankment takes only 20 minutes. The area is also served by the London Overground, and it's very close to Liverpool Street National Rail Station. As you said, Ine, the area is well known for all the wrong reasons, specifically for its association with Jack the Ripper, a serial killer who, during the 19th century, prowled Whitechapel's alleyways and public houses, searching for his next victim. Sizable industry has arisen from his dreadful legacy, but any visitors to Whitechapel these days will discover not only an area with a history that predates the Ripper, but currently a place of great diversity and energy. Whitechapel, I guess, would now be classed as part of the inner city of London, but back in the 1500s it was outside the city's walls and home to some of the dirtier, smellier industries, including slaughterhouses and tanneries. Those have long since disappeared, but one of the industries which has survived is the Whitechapel Bell Foundry. They began making bells in 1570 and are still doing so today. The foundry provided 2 bells to Westminster Abbey in 1583, and remarkably, those are still in use over 400 years later. They also produced Big Ben, the mammoth bell that rings out across the capital each and every hour of each and every day. And remember a couple of podcasts back we told you that an architect from Leeds designed the Capitol building in the United States? Well, we Brits, well, specifically the Whitechapel Bell Foundry, also provided your famous Liberty Bell. Don't say we don't do anything for you.
Wow, is it possible to visit the foundry?
Yeah, you can call in and see their museum displays in their shop foyer during the week, but the foundry also offers occasional tours of their working premises on a Saturday. Have a look at their website to see the dates for 2015 and book quickly. The tours are very, very popular.
We didn't see the foundry when we visited last weekend. It's a pity. Actually, we didn't manage to visit as many places as we would have liked. There is a lot to see and do around the Whitechapel.
That's right. As I said earlier, the place has a fascinating history. Did you ever see the 1980 movie The Elephant Man? It's one of David Lynch's more accessible films. Well, the protagonist, Joseph Merrick, who in less enlightened days was seen as something of a human curiosity, resided at the Royal London Hospital in Whitechapel. The hospital operates a small museum where you can find out more about Merrick and also see special sections on forensic medicine and medical advances since the 18th century. Unfortunately, it's only open from Tuesday to Friday, so don't plan a visit there over the weekend. Fans of contemporary art may be interested to visit the Whitechapel Gallery, opened in 1901. The gallery has exhibited work by international artists of the standing of Mark Rothko, Pablo Picasso, Jackson Pollock and Frida Kahlo, as well as showcasing the talents of homegrown artists such as Gilbert and George, David Hockney and Lucian Freud.
I also noticed a lot of South Asian shops and street signs in both English and another language.
Yeah, I did say that Whitechapel was a very diverse area, and it's possible to chart the changing demographics by looking at the history of the building, which is currently the Brick Lane Great Mosque. When it was built in the 1740s, it was a Protestant church, a place of worship for the Huguenot French who had fled persecution in their home country. It then transformed into a Wesleyan chapel in 1809, before the Methodists took it over 10 years later. Further waves of immigration to the area, this time of Jewish settlers from Russia and Central Europe, resulted in the building being used as a synagogue in the late 19th century. It evolved again, this time into a mosque in 1976, providing a place of worship for the many Bangladeshi Muslims who had set up home in this part of the city between the 1950s and the 1970s. There's another mosque, one of the largest in Europe, in fact, on Whitechapel Road, which can hold around 7,000 worshippers. After years of lobbying, it was eventually built and opened in the mid-1980s. An extension, the London Muslim Centre, was constructed in the early 2000s on land which had been vacant since the Germans obliterated it during World War II, which I would suggest demonstrates how little funding had been provided for the regeneration of the area in the intervening years. So in A, this is why you'll see some street signs in the area in both English and Bengali.
Got it. And lots of curry houses too.
Correct. Brick Lane is famous for such cuisine, although I think that nowadays there's more competition from other establishments elsewhere, and you're likely to find an equally good Indian, Pakistani or Bangladeshi meal in other parts of the capital. That said, if you are in the area, it would be rude not to try out one of these restaurants and take advantage if one of the vendors tries to entice you inside with an offer of discount or free drinks. Although you may have to remind the waiting staff of that at the end of your meal.
What about the Truman Brewery? It's a fairly dominant building in the area.
Indeed. As you head north along Brick Lane, you'll see a large brick building with a huge chimney. That's the old brewery, you can't miss it. Now, as far as we can tell, brewing had taken place here from around the 1660s, right up until the late 1980s. By that stage, however, competition had become too fierce and production ceased. Thankfully, the building remained intact and it's been converted into a multi-purpose facility housing bars, restaurants, art and office space and shops. It looks as though it's aimed at the young, cool kids, but even the old folk like Inhe and I can enjoy the food and the market stalls, and there's a fancy bowling alley and karaoke room as well. The old brewery and the surrounding areas provide a very popular backdrop, and numerous musicians and large corporations have used it as a location for videos or advertising campaigns. Our Korean listeners might be aware, for example, that G-Dragon shot his Bidak Hage video there a few years ago.
Sticking with the art theme, there's a lot of street art to enjoy.
Yeah, you'll see loads of that type of thing around Brick Lane as you head towards Shoreditch High Street Station. I quite like it. It can add real character to an area. Though being from Belfast, I've seen some murals that might be considered slightly intimidating. Certainly potential investors don't like some of the paintings that you can find in parts of Belfast, deeming it to be a threatening marker of territory, and at that point it becomes hugely counterproductive. And I've seen some highly inappropriate propaganda in other countries too, which is particularly upsetting when you see it in schools and playgrounds. But we saw some amazing stuff in Tongyeong and in other parts of South Korea too. It's something that everyone in the community, young and old, gets involved in, and as I say, it really adds colour, character and pride to such areas. I must admit that I'm not overly familiar with any of the artists whose work is on display in the UK, apart from Banksy maybe, only really know his name, but we hope to put that right when we go on a street art tour in Bristol, which might be considered our country's spiritual home of graffiti, and we hope to go there sometime in the next couple of months. Regardless, I don't at all mind the art in and around Brick Lane. It's mostly fun and enjoyable to look at. I'm sure some of it is quite political. The area has, after all, been a hotbed of radical thinking for years. I mean, the Bolshevik Congress of 1907 was held around there, attended by Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin, and all the other characters from Animal Farm. We've put a slideshow of some of the art on our homepage. Check it out.
Let's finish our round of Whitechapel by explaining why we were there in the first place.
Good idea. We were attending an architecture event at the Cass Bank Gallery, part of the London Metropolitan University. They're currently running an exhibition entitled Out of the Ordinary, showcasing the work of young Korean architects, many of whom, like yourself, Inhe, are award-winning designers. The exhibition opened last weekend, and we attended a workshop run by one of the participants, Joho Architecture, and listened into a panel discussion on what it means to be a young architect in both the UK and Korea.
This talk was very well attended by a British architecture student. The panel included professor, critics, and Korean architect. They discussed the limitation on young architects, but also highlighted opportunities, including new way of working with different materials and with a lower budget. I think the audience learned a lot about architecture in Korea.
I have to admit that I was quite struck by how personable the architects were. Although I'm not so well versed in Korean architects, those whose work was in show all run their own practices and have significant reputations in Korea. But all were more than happy to help me as I struggled with the workshop task. Although it was open to everyone, I think I was the only non-architect there, and it showed. And they also were happy to talk to us more about their work. Mr. Jung-hoon Lee, who runs his own architecture firm in Seoul, Joho Architecture, who I mentioned earlier, and who had formerly worked in London for Zaha Hadid, was kind enough to tell us why London is such a great place, not only for architects, but for anyone involved in the creative industries.
I think the London architecture style is very international. There are many very prestigious architects like Zaha Hadid and Norman Foster, and many architects, they're reading the international style. So of course in Paris also there are many good architects, but in my opinion the English architect, especially in London, is very international. Their style is very active, dynamic, and very advanced, experimental. That's the point that I really like it, and that's the reason that I came back to London to get some inspiration. I think the UK, especially in London, is the center point of the design field. It's not just limited for architects, it's all over the design field, like industrial design and the fashion design or architecture design. The point is related to each other very deeply, that's the point. But in Korea, I think somehow it's split. So fashion design just focused on fashion. The industrial design just, know the industrial one. But here in London, in my opinion, it's really mixed and confused, very positively. That's the very impressive point for me. Yeah, that's the reason I like London.
And they also told us the current financial climate is actually presenting opportunities for young Korean architects in their homeland.
My opinion, in Korea, there are many chances to construct for the young architect. Because it's compared to the English, the British, or the French people. I think it's because it depends on the economic situation. In Korea, of course, it's very difficult right nowadays. It sounds very tough, but anyway, there are many chances to rewrite, try and experiment or something for new architect for Korea. So I just want to use this chance. So try to use a different material, within limited budget. That's the very important point for young architects.
Yeah, the conclusion of the panel discussion was that young architects face the same constraints in both the UK and Korea. Basically, if you're working for a big practice, there's very little chance that a rookie designer will be able to influence the direction of a certain project. Now, I would have thought it would have been worse in Korea, given the deference shown to elders or seniors in the workplace. But in the UK, we also have a big problem, specifically our aversion to risk. So it appears that while there are opportunities in Korea for young architects to set up their own practices and provide services to clients, it would be much harder in the UK because few clients will want to hire an architect who's only got a university education but little experience in the workplace. And that could potentially result in the loss of more diverse solutions to, for example, housing problems. A British Korean architect in the audience made the point that they didn't necessarily want to build big, they just wanted to be able to think big, to consider how their designs work within their environmental context, and how they can better the lives of those who use the space. Unfortunately, the ability to turn those ideas into reality is somewhat limited for young architects. Another point that I found myself agreeing with, based on your experience, Inhe, was made by one of the panellists, an architect who now runs her own practice in the UK. She stated that she learnt more while working in Seoul for a year than she would if she had stayed in the UK. And when I consider the kind of work you did, from concept to design, site supervision, basically seeing a project through from start to finish, I can absolutely see where she's coming from. Anyway, the exhibition runs until the 28th of February. If you're in London and have an interest in architecture, do get yourself along. It's free and you'll be able to see some fine examples of the exciting new designs cropping up around Korea. Highly recommended.
Indeed. It was a fascinating exhibition. Let's head back towards home and talk about its Dulwich.
There's a twofold objective in us extolling the virtues of Southeast London. First, these are areas off the well-trodden tourist track that might be of interest to listeners, and they might be able to pick up a few tips for making their hard-earned cash go a little further as well. Did you know, for example, that the average price of a hotel room in central London in 2014 was £126 per night? If you have a look on Airbnb, you can find two-bedroom flats in Southeast London for less than that. Okay, it might appear to be a bit out of the way, but in fact it's only 13 minutes on the train from London Bridge to East Dulwich, and it offers a bit of respite from the hustle and bustle of the city. The second reason for promoting Southeast London is that we're happily ensconced here at present, and want to spend time taking advantage of what it has to offer, and supporting the various independent traders here while we're at it. As you might have noticed, our podcast is very London-centric. This project is a hobby for us, we aren't paid to do it, and we've got other commitments to balance alongside. We can only get out of the city about once per month at present, so we'll make the most of our local area while we're here.
Don't bore the listeners with all your explanations. Let's just cut to the chase.
All right. Okay, East Dulwich, lovely part of London. We took a leisurely stroll in a southerly direction from Goose Green, with the intention of catching a glimpse of the street art in this area too, finding somewhere for a nice cup of coffee, and ultimately ending up at the Dulwich Picture Gallery. It wasn't an outrageous plan, but it was a relaxing and enjoyable way to spend a Sunday.
Although East Dulwich is much more gentrified than Whitechapel, there is a lot of street art here too. We'll try to map it at some stage, but it's worth having a walk down the side street of the main road, Lordship Lane, in order to discover it.
I think, although I'm more than happy for listeners to correct me on this, that a lot of it came about as a result of a festival run in 2013, which invited numerous artists to replicate the work found in the nearby Dulwich Gallery, in their own style, on gable ends in the vicinity. Clearly no one has found them an eyesore, and as is the case in Whitechapel, I feel that they add a bit of brightness and character to the area. Again, we've got another slideshow on our homepage, so you can get some idea of the type of thing we're talking about.
Yeah, I liked it too. We also succeeded in finding a nice coffee shop.
Yeah, it was a great spot by you, actually. We'd wandered off the main road, and after having a look around a vintage shop, sadly in the throes of a closing down sale, you spotted the Blue Brick Cafe. It's on the corner of Felbrigg Road and Shawbury Road, and we managed to get a seat before it got too busy.
We just had a couple of cup of coffee.
And a nice bit of carrot cake.
But the cafe also offers a lot of vegetarian food. The atmosphere was very nice. The tables are positioned so that you'll probably end up sharing with other people. But that's okay. London can be a lonely place, so any chance to interact with others is a good thing.
As you say, the atmosphere was in keeping with the rest of the area, very laid back, and we weren't rushed into finishing our drinks. Definitely a nice little spot to spend an hour reading the paper on a Sunday morning or afternoon.
We continued on our journey through Dulwich Park to the Dulwich Picture Gallery. This is England's first purpose-built public gallery.
You could say that it came about through luck rather than design, admittedly, and the gallery's website has a great timeline detailing the events that shaped what we find there today. In brief, a combination of existing artwork from the nearby Dulwich College, alongside other pieces originally intended for the King of Poland, came to be housed in a building which was designed by Sir John Soane. Two of the men who had provided parts of the collection were adamant that this gallery should be open to the public, and that has indeed been the case since 1817.
Unfortunately, it's not free to visit. The entrance fee is £6. But the free tours, which take place at 3 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday, are great.
Yeah, our guide was fantastic. I'm really sorry that we didn't catch her name, but we did manage to tell her afterwards how much she added to our visit. She was 82 years old and had been an art teacher for 40 years. Providing these tours gave her the opportunity to keep sharing her passion with others, and she delivered her tour in a really accessible way. She told us about the history of the building and of the paintings, and I was particularly interested to learn that one of the small Rembrandt paintings had been stolen four times since 1966, Fortunately, they'd always managed to get it back again. I thought it was fantastic how she related the artwork back to the modern day. For example, she focused on a painting by Guercino from the early 1620s called The Woman Taken in Adultery. In this, Christ is seen remonstrating with an official as a woman, charged with adultery and about to be stoned as a punishment, is held tight by a Roman soldier. The scene is taken from St. John's Gospel, and Jesus tells the official that whichever of you is free from sin shall cast the first stone at her. In a world where some women are still subjected to such draconian treatment, this piece, with its messages of mercy, forgiveness and understanding, still has the power to affect the viewer. As I've said in a previous podcast, I prefer the classical arts to modern art simply because I think I can understand better what the artist is depicting. But this tour showed me that there are hidden depths, and I was really grateful to the guide for pointing these out so eloquently. It really did make the visit much more enjoyable and worthwhile.
You mentioned Rembrandt and Guercino, but there are also works in the gallery by Canaletto, one of your favorite, Van Dyck, Velázquez, and Raphael. And there was just the permanent collection. There are also other special exhibitions running throughout the year.
And like other galleries such as the Tate, Dulwich has moved with the times to put their entire collection online so that those who can't travel in person can see what they hold. Rest assured we'll add a link to that on our blog.
The picture gallery is probably the main attraction in Dulwich, but as Chris said, it's not a bad place for a base for yourself if you are visiting London. There are plenty of nice restaurants and independent shops along the main street.
Not to mention a great charity shop, St. Christopher's Hospice, where you can pick up some second-hand books for a knockdown price. £1 for Orlando Figg's A People's Tragedy. Unbelievable.
And it is fairly easy to reach it from central London.
And with that ringing endorsement, we'll wrap things up for this week. What are we doing next weekend?
Not sure yet.
We'll think of something. Join us then.
Bye for now.